Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Some governments are urging people to avoid unsafe crowding on trains and buses by riding bicycles. The suggestion comes as countries ease coronavirus-based restrictions on business and other activities. But cycling activists say governments could do more, and some people are not welcoming of bicycles. Countries and cities across the world are considering how bicycles can help their economies open up again. In Bogota, Mayor Claudia Lopez has urged everybody returning to work this week to cycle to their jobs instead of using public transportation. The French government has asked cycling activist Pierre Cern to create a plan for when its lockdown ends on May 11th. His suggestions include the creation of bicycle lanes separated from other vehicles. The estimated cost for such a change is 50,000 euros per kilometer. It is unclear if the French government will accept Cern's ideas. For now, France has said it will give riders as much as 50 euros, nearly $55, for bicycle repairs. In Berlin, Germany, the Friedrichshain-Kreuzberg Council painted yellow lines on some roads to define them as bike-only, taking the space from existing car lanes. This bike system builds on what is called tactical urbanism, city developments that are low-cost, simple, and easy. Similar programs are appearing elsewhere, in Lima, Peru, Barcelona, Spain, and Milan, Italy. Officials are moving quickly on plans to expand bike paths or take driving space from cars. From Germany to Peru, cycling activists want to make more changes for travelers on two wheels. As cities open up across the world, they see a more important way to involve bicycles. Morten Kabel co-chairs the European Cyclists Federation. The move to more bike-friendly environments is necessary if we want our cities to work, Kabel said. He added, a lot of people will be afraid of going on public transportation, but we have to get back to work someday. Very few of our cities can handle more car traffic. In addition to separate bike lanes, Kabel is pushing for government financial support for electric bicycles. Such support would persuade commuters who have more difficult journeys to use bikes. Cycling supporters say many minds still must be changed. They note that many officials have called for more use of private vehicles during the lockdown. Different countries had different policies about bicycles. In Britain, where people are still permitted to leave home to exercise, cycle shops have remained open during the lockdown that began March 23rd. But in Spain, the government closed such shops but permitted gasoline stations to remain open. And while bike sharing in London and Paris was provided free to healthcare workers, Most Spanish cities shut down the services, saying they would help spread the coronavirus. Madrid's successful bike-sharing operation reopened only last week. Bikes are disinfected nightly, and riders must wear gloves. Still, bicycles are not accepted everywhere. Juan Pasamar lives in Zaragoza, Spain. He said police stopped him as he traveled to work on a bicycle. The attitude of the police is the attitude that many people show in the streets, said Pasamar, who keeps riding, even at the risk of being stopped again. He said, bicycles are for many just a nuisance. I'm John Russell.
This past Monday, May 4th, was Star Wars Day. The holiday began in 2011 to celebrate the film series and its influence on popular culture. Every Star Wars Day, fans around the world say, "May the 4th be with you." The words "May the 4th" sound like "May the Force," part of a line from character Obi-Wan Kenobi. "May the Force be with you" is something he said often in the films. Star Wars has influenced English speech in many ways. Today, for example, English dictionaries contain words from the films, such as Jedi, though its meaning has changed a little. But Star Wars has also brought us unusual sentence structures, mainly influenced by the speech of the character Jedi trainer Yoda. He is the beloved 900-year-old green creature who shows character Luke Skywalker how to become a Jedi. Yoda's way of speaking is the most memorable thing about him, except for his unusual appearance. Today, Everyday Grammar will look at a few of Yoda's lines to examine the sentence formation. This is a fun way to practice identifying the many parts of speech in English. Before we begin, let's look at three important parts of speech. A subject is a noun, noun phrase, or pronoun that performs the action of a verb in a sentence. For example, Yoda is the subject of the sentence, "Yoda teaches Luke Skywalker about the Force." A verb is a word that expresses an action, happening, or state of being. In the same sentence example, the verb is teaches. And an object is a noun, noun phrase, or pronoun that receives the action of a verb. In the sentence, the object is Luke Skywalker. Notice the word order goes like this: subject, verb, object. Most English sentences and clauses follow this word order. Not all sentences have objects, but knowing where to put them is useful. Yoda almost never uses the subject-verb word order of standard English. And many of his sentences contain linking verbs. A linking verb is a verb that connects the subject of a sentence to a subject complement, which is a word or phrase that describes the subject. Listen to a sentence that uses normal English word order and has a linking verb.
The mind of a child is truly wonderful.
In this sentence, the subject is the mind of a child, The linking verb is, and the subject complement is truly wonderful. Now, listen to how Yoda said this sentence in the Star Wars film, Attack of the Clones.
Truly wonderful the mind of a child is.
Here, Yoda put the subject complement, truly wonderful, first, the subject, the mind of a child, next, and the linking verb is last. Often, when a sentence has a subject complement, Yoda puts it at the beginning. Listen to this example from the film The Empire Strikes Back.
Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter.
In this sentence, the words luminous beings are the subject complement. Are is the linking verb, and we is the subject. But note that Yoda put the subject at the end this time, rather than after the subject complement. Generally speaking, Yoda's sentence structure was not consistent. And that is okay, since he is an imaginary character and written to be hundreds of years old. We can still enjoy exploring his sentences to see where he places things. Another thing Yoda does often is to separate main verbs from auxiliary verbs or modal verbs in sentences that contain them. Suppose you wanted to tell Luke Skywalker something about Darth Vader. Normally, English sentences put auxiliary verbs before main verbs, like this.
And you will confront him.
Here, the auxiliary verb is will and comes before the main verb, confront. Together, will confront makes the simple future verb tense. But listen to how Yoda says that same sentence about Vader from the film Return of the Jedi.
And confront him you will.
Notice that he has completely separated the auxiliary and main verbs. He put the auxiliary will at the end of the sentence and the main verb confront at the beginning. Even in this same piece of dialogue, however, the old green teacher forms sentences other ways. Listen to more of the Yoda speech in three short sentences.
You must confront Vader. Then, only then, a Jedi will you be. And confront him you will.
In each of these sentences, he places the subject, the modal or auxiliary, and the main verb in different places. The writers of the Star Wars movies made Yoda's speech inconsistent in structure, maybe just to play with language. And now it is your turn to have some fun with language. Visit our website to find a few more Yoda quotes and see if you can identify the parts of speech. May the Force be with you. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week, our series brings us to the events of 2008. It was a year that combined one of the nation's worst financial crises with one of its most exciting elections in recent history. In 2006 and 2007, the American housing market began to collapse. Home values had been going up and up. Now the balloon burst. People started losing homes they had bought with money borrowed on easy credit terms, loans they were then unable to repay. The hope was that the crisis in the housing market could be contained and that it would not spread to the wider economy. Traditionally, local banks would have suffered the losses on the bad loans, but times had changed. Big investment banks had been buying those loans. The investment banks then resold them as securities offering high returns. Credit rating agencies working for the investment banks had told investors that the securities were safe. Selling a financial product based on a large group of loans was supposed to limit the risk if a few loans went bad. That was the idea. But that was before millions of homeowners stopped paying their mortgage loans. Mortgage-backed securities became known as toxic assets. No one wanted to be anywhere near them. In March of 2008, Bear Stearns became the first investment bank to fail as a result of the crisis. Others followed. In September, Lehman Brothers, the nation's fourth largest investment bank, sought protection in bankruptcy court. Its failure only deepened the fears in credit markets. Toward the end of 2008, an international credit freeze developed. No one wanted to take the risk of lending money to banks or other companies that might have owned toxic assets. Some people feared that there could even be a global depression, the first since the 1930s. The United States economy, the world's largest, started shrinking at the end of 2007. The unemployment rate started rising. President George W. Bush's administration, Congress, and the central bank, the Federal Reserve, took extraordinary steps to deal with the growing financial crisis. Their efforts included loans to banks, automakers, and other companies. The aim was to rescue businesses that officials considered too big to fail. The bailouts from Washington were a decision that not all of the American people agreed with. But the people also had to make a decision of their own in 2008. It was a presidential election year, and the candidates were some of the most diverse in the nation's history. The Republican Party nominated Arizona Senator John McCain. At 72, he would have taken office as the nation's oldest first-term president.
So stand up with me, my friends. Stand up and fight for America, for her strength, her ideals, and her future. The contest begins tonight.
John McCain had been a Navy pilot during the Vietnam War. In 1967, the North Vietnamese shot down his plane and took him prisoner. He was tortured and held for more than 5 years. He returned home a hero. During the presidential campaign, he spoke often about his experience as a prisoner of war. His campaign message was, "Country first." Senator McCain quickly secured the Republican nomination to succeed George W. Bush. The Democrats needed more time to choose a nominee. The race settled on two leading candidates. One of them was Hillary Clinton. Her husband was former President Bill Clinton. They spent 8 years living in the White House. As First Lady, she held an unusually public role in her husband's administration. Later, she was twice elected as a senator from New York. Now she was trying to return to the White House, this time as the first woman president of the United States.
So if you want a winner who knows how to take them on, I'm your girl.
The other leading candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination would also make history if elected. He was a first-term United States Senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. He was born in Hawaii to a white mother from Kansas and a black father from Kenya. If he won, he would be America's first black president. Blacks in the United States had been slaves until 1863. They were not permitted to vote until 1870. Women in the United States did not have a constitutional right to vote until 1920. And not until the 1960s did federal civil rights laws bar discrimination against either group. During the nominating fight between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, there was a lot of discussion and debate in America about gender and race. Some talked about the problems that women still faced in society and wondered whether Americans could accept a woman as president. Others talked about the problems that blacks still faced in society and wondered whether Americans could accept a black man as president.
I think we're ready. Well, I hope we're ready.
I just hear people comments, that'll be the day when we have a black man running our country, yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
Candidate Obama gave a speech about race in America.
I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II, and a wild white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America, and I've lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents. And for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. It's a story that hasn't made me the most conventional of candidates, but it is a story that has seared into my genetic makeup the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many, we are truly one.
Many political experts predicted that Barack Obama would lose the nomination. For one thing, he was still new to many Americans, while almost everyone knew who Hillary Clinton was. Also, she had many wealthy supporters donating to her campaign. But political scientist Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia said those experts did not understand the country's mood.
They underestimated the power not just of Barack Obama, but also the yearning for change and the antipathy toward dynasty. The idea that the Bushes and the Clintons would essentially control the presidency from 1988 to potentially 2016.
Hope and change became the messages of the Obama campaign. Barack Obama won enough delegates to secure his party's nomination, which he accepted in August, shortly after his 47th birthday. His choice for vice president was Joe Biden, a longtime senator from Delaware. But Mr. Obama's nomination was not the biggest news story for long. The next day, John McCain had a big announcement of his own. His running mate would be Sarah Palin. The Democrats had once nominated a woman for vice president, Geraldine Ferraro, but never the Republicans. Neither party had ever nominated a woman for president.
Sarah Palin was the 44-year-old governor of Alaska. Few Americans had ever heard of her until she spoke at the Republican nominating convention. She referred to herself as a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
Some women said they admired her ability to balance work and family as the mother of five children.
I feel like she really speaks for me and represents me.
During the campaign, Barack Obama raised a record amount of money for a candidate, about $745 million. He became the first candidate to reject the modern system of public financing of presidential elections. Instead, he accepted smaller contributions from hundreds of thousands of supporters. His campaign made extensive use of the internet to collect donations, connect with voters, and organize volunteers. John McCain did not have as much money to spend. Something else also set him apart from the Democratic nominee. John McCain supported the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Barack Obama said he would bring the troops home from Iraq within 2 years of becoming president. But the top issue in the campaign was the economy. Again, Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia.
The fundamental issue in most presidential elections is the economy. It really is the economy, stupid, the old slogan from the 1992 Clinton campaign. When an administration has a positive, strong economy, they're tough to beat, even if it's a non-incumbent running. But when the economy turns sour, they're halfway out the door.
Barack Obama and John McCain agreed on at least one thing in dealing with the economy. They both supported President Bush's call for the government to bail out the financial industry. Many Americans disliked the idea of helping banks that had acted irresponsibly. But Congress agreed to let the government buy bad loans from banks and temporarily become part owner of some rescued companies. Supporters argued that the bailouts were needed to save the economy from collapse. In November of 2008, Americans elected Barack Hussein Obama as their 44th president. He received 53% of the popular vote. He won some states that had not chosen a Democrat in many years. A little more than 60% of voting age Americans cast their ballots, the highest percentage since 1964. Support for Barack Obama was especially strong among young people and African Americans. Many voters were emotional on election night.
I'm speechless. I'm trying not to cry right now. I'm thinking of my great-grandfather, my grandmother, and man, this is amazing.
Because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
But the election of 2008 was not the end of America's economic problems. What became known as the Great Recession would officially end in June of 2009, 6 months into the new president's term. But its lasting effects would continue to be felt all the way into the 2012 election season.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.